This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're going to talk about Iran, what's going on there, why is it happening now, and what, if anything, the United States should do. To address this issue, I've turned to Eli Lake. He's a columnist who writes about national security and foreign affairs for Bloomberg View, and he's written for Reason over the years as well. Eli, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Nick.
So let's get to it. What is happening in Iran? And I hate to say Iran, but, you know, that's the time that I grew up. And what's happening in Iran right now with the demonstrations against the Islamic government there?
Well, first of all, we have less of a window because the government shut down most internet functions. So we're finding that, like, when we get videos, they're usually a couple days old at this point, and it's not like it was 11 days ago when all of this started. But we've seen kind of rolling protests throughout the country, as opposed to 2009, where we just largely saw this in Tehran. And they are not from the upper middle class, sort of, you know, the elites in Iran. They are really from the working class, and they were originally protests that were about the kind of economic inequality, but in this system, in the Iranian system, really is about just sort of how, you know, the henchmen of the dictator, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, are, you know, like, kind of run the a lot of the Iranian economy like the mafia. So there was a frustration, and some of it was because there had been banks that had failed, pension funds that were failing, and they sort of saw that, you know, there were a lot of, you know, regime figures who were, you know, raking in tons of money. And so this was a part of it. But
so are the demonstrations, I mean, do we know if the demonstrations all over the country are about the same thing, or is, you know, I mean, you were talking about Tehran, which has one kind of, you know, it's the largest city, and it's the hub of, you know, the cultural and economic power. But then, like, as you start moving out into smaller and smaller areas or regions, are they, you know, are they protesting against the same issues?
Well, there has been a common theme, which is that, you know, they started off sort of, you know, literally about the price of eggs, but then, like we saw in 2009, almost, in an instant, turned into chants against the dictator and the regime. And this confirms something that we should have known since the late 1990s, which is that there are millions of Iranians, they're not just students we know anymore, they're just millions of Iranians who don't want to live under a kind of corrupt, clerical fascist state, which Iran is. And there has been efforts at reform, starting with the election in 97 of Mohammad Khatami as president. He was stymied by the permanent sort of deep state of Iran to implement any of the reforms, even though he objected to them. He could do nothing to stop the crackdown against, in 1999, against Tehran University students who were demonstrating then. And by the way, who was the person who authorized this crackdown and these arrests? It was none other than Hassan Rouhani, the magical moderate who Obama promised us was, you know, a reformer, which he is not. We saw it in the 2000s with a figure that I wrote a lot about at the time named Akbar Ghanji, who now lives in Toronto. But he was in jail and he got a lot of attention because he wrote an open letter to the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, saying you should stand for an election. We saw it again in 2009 when they were chanting death to the dictator after they stole the election of what was known at the time as the Green Movement. And then we're seeing it again in 2017-2018, which, again, it starts off as a sort of concern about where are the benefits of this Iran deal? Why, you know, why are we economically less secure than after the big deal with the Great Satan? But they quickly turn to what is the kind of common theme in Iran for more than 20 years or, you know, around 20 years now, which is, you know, we don't want to be ruled by an unaccountable, corrupt system that is basically, you know, is able to stay in power through mass arrests and fear and these kinds of things. And one of the most extraordinary things is that they're saying, you know, I give my life to Iran, not for Gaza, not for Lebanon, not for Syria. Now, that's very interesting because, you know, the assumption many analysts had was that, you know, these foreign predations from the Iranians that we've seen in the last few years were widely popular because Iranians are a proud people. they're sort of saying, like, what are you doing? Like, you know, we got all
well,
these problems.
And not simply that Iranians are a proud people, but that Muslims are transnational one way or the other, right? That Islam is not, you know, unlike, and, you know, I'm laughing as I say it, unlike, say, Roman Catholicism, Islam is a transnational phenomenon. So, so of course, Iran is going to help Syria out, you know,
well, that's
et cetera.
That's the propaganda of the regime. But what ended up happening is that in order to, you know, of course, Iran will help Syria out. Assad and his father were allies, and now I would say Bashar is a client of the Iranians. But that prompted other Muslim powers in the region, namely Saudi Arabia, to say, wait a second, you're on the side of a dictator who's gassing his own people. And that is another thing we should never lose sight of. That in the moment of this high diplomacy with the Iranians under Obama, they were underwriting and they were the lifeline for, you know, a dictator committing the worst atrocity of the 21st century
but
so far. Let's
what
hope
about
it's-
yeah? What about you know? How does the Iran deal play into this? Because you know, on one level, you know, obviously the promised delivery of those, you know, planes full of cash. Of various kinds of currency has not made it to the Iranian people, so they're kind of pissed off. But did brokering a deal with the great Satan actually remove one of the props that the regime was able to say, oh, this is why, you know, just simmer down and settle down. You know, this is not a time for change, or don't mess with us because we're locked in a dead, you know, a twilight struggle with the great Satan. Yeah,
that's an argument that I've been seeing from some of the Obama administration alumni, and mainly Wendy Sherman made this point in a Time magazine piece. And I don't think it's correct because of a couple things. The first is that the regime is blamed. I mean, Khamenei has been blaming the United States, Saudi Arabia and Israel for the unrest anyway. Second of all, the Iranian people have not wanted to be ruled by Khamenei as a supreme leader now for some time, long before the Obama administration, or for that matter, the George W. Bush administration. It's been a widely, I think, much more popular sentiment than a lot of analysts have sort of said. And, you know, finally, you could argue perhaps that there was an expectation that was raised by Rouhani. But Rouhani also promised in his campaigns to free political prisoners and to focus on human rights. And he hasn't done any of that. I mean, recently he said that there was going to be, you know, I guess, a sort of reform to the moral police. But he has not been able to do any of these kinds of domestic reforms and is instead largely focused on trying to get this large amount of European investment in Iran. But again, that investment goes to the economic elites, the people who are connected to the Revolutionary
Guard.
Wait,
so what you're saying, and this seems to me to be a problem with certainly post-World War II, 20th century diplomacy or foreign policy, what you're saying is that what's happening in Iran mostly has to do with people who live and work and oppress people within Iran. It's not to say the larger geopolitical situation doesn't matter, but that it's fundamentally what we're looking at here is a people who have been under a consistently awful, repressive, economically idiotic government since 1979. And at various points, they've said, you know, come on, we want something different. We want something different. And that's what's happening again here.
Right. I don't think Iranians are on the street saying, you know, America, please invade us, or we can't do this without your help, Donald Trump. That's not what's happening. What I think they have been saying is we want to be a normal country already, and that they can't be a normal country when their leadership are these, you know, crazed, greedy fanatics. So can we
talk about that a little bit? How much of it is that, and I realize it's, you know, certainly a mix of things, but you know, would they be okay with, you know, theocrats if the theocrats weren't hypocrites? Or is it more that they don't want to be ruled by theocrats, you know, especially corrupt ones who are, you know, somehow making bank, you know, while they have to suffer depredations and morals police?
You know, I'm going to say I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think there is an easy answer to that. I think that there's certainly plenty of educated Iranians who want to be able to watch whatever movies they want and not have to worry about a knock on the door if they have some liquor in their home or something like that. That I know. I was there in 2002, and I kind of talked to Iranians who told me about this all the time, and you know, there's sort of an attitude there where it's like, yeah, well, you know, it's technically forbidden, but it's permissible. You know, there's a kind of look the other way. But that is the basis of any kind of corrupt system. When you have a bunch of rules that are enforced arbitrarily, that's when, you know, that's a hallmark of a corrupt system. And I think it erodes confidence overall. I don't think that there's that many Iranians besides the fanatics in what's known as the Basij that really believe in the revolution with the same fervor as certainly supporters of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. I think that that's kind of petered out. And so, but on the other hand, there are still, it's a very religious country. And the notion that, you know, you could maybe have a scenario where there would be some kind of respect for Islamic law, but not having the kind of corruption that maybe that would be very popular in a different context. But I think right now they just sort of looking around and saying the system is rotten to a core, and you know, we're not getting what we want out of it. So we want to change.
Is there a way to well, you know, before we get to the question of how this might play out, or will it catch this time? Is there a way when these kind of moments happen to understand, you know, that this one is different, you know, or why they're happening now? Because if you say it's not really related to the Iran deal, it's probably not really related to Syria or Saudi Arabia. Is it related to the collapse of Iraq as a regional adversary? You know, in Tunisia, when the Arab Spring started, you know, there was that, you know, that horrifying moment when a fruit vendor lit himself on fire because he was frustrated. And that seemed to, you know, that was the match that lit a broader revolt.
Right.
Hosni Mubarak getting old and sick in Egypt, it allowed for an opening for a, you know, an uprising, which may or may not have really accomplished anything. But, you know, is there any reason or is it worth trying to pinpoint what is different this time? Or is it just, you know, when you oppress people for a long time, you know, you're constantly kind of, it's like a flint hitting a piece of steel. It's constantly throwing off sparks. And every once in a while, those just catch into a bigger conflagration.
Well, I think you hit it. I mean, to quote the mighty Mos Def, why did one straw break the camel's back? Here's the secret, the million other straws underneath it.
And of course, there he was talking about his controversial opinions about 9/11.
9/11.
Right. And that, right. It was for those who don't know, the very talented, actually, Mos Def, a very good actor as well,
great
who
rapper.
Is a 9/11 truther. But so it really is just kind of like, that's all I can take. I can't take no more type of thing.
Well, I mean, I don't want to. I think that we're still going to learn, you know, we're going to learn more about this over the next year. The one thing I would say as a matter of how to approach it is, I think it's the beginning of a moment. It's not like the regime is going to fall tomorrow. And it's impossible to predict those kind of tipping points. There's just too much information that we can't possibly know. I have reason to believe that some of this is a little bit more organized nationally than it appears, but it's, looks like it's a leaderless movement.
Now, you say that. Why do you believe that? Do you actually have sources, or are you playing a hunch? And I know, you know, like a rogue cop, you play by your own rules. But, you know, we're talking about reporting here. This isn't the Michael right. Wolff show. This is the Reason podcast. Okay,
I don't want to get too much into it because I'm still working on it. But I have covered the Iranian opposition now for some time, and mm-hmm. by the Iranian opposition, I don't mean the monarchists or the MEK. I mean the real the people who I would consider to be sort of a liberal opposition. And I just believe that there is more behind the scenes, but it's not. But I think it's also true that there isn't like a leader of it the way there was in the Green moment,
right?
Where, you know, everybody sort of got behind Mousavi and Karoubi, who were the two political leaders running for president, who they believe had the election stolen. I want to just go back to something you said earlier, which I think was a really good point, which was it requires some analytic humility, that it's not always about us. And I think that, you know, as I kind of drift closer to libertarianism in my middle age, I have really come to appreciate that the triumphalism of neoconservatism, which is to say our interventions can change a country, the flip side of that is like the Obama view that, like, you know, this negotiation can transform the politics. And it's like we have to have a little bit of humility that there is a dynamic in these countries independent of America, despite what the leadership says, or however much they want to use America as a foil in their own propaganda. And, you know, that is an important sort of thing. It doesn't lead me to say that we should never intervene or that we don't have a stake in this. I think that there's a lot that regular people, but plus the government and governments in the West can do to support and show solidarity with the Iranian freedom movement. But at the same time, we should understand that we're not the decisive factor. It's going to be ultimately people on the ground and how they organize and whether they can persuade elements of the regime to ultimately defect by convincing them that, like, you know, it's safe. We're not going to chop your head off if you come to our side.
And what are the lessons that we might learn from failed attempts to, overthrow the regime, or at least heavily, you know, alter it in 2009 and 1999?
I don't think we did anything really in 99 or 2009. I mean,
But I'm saying within Iran, like what are the lessons that that the rebels themselves might learn about what is necessary?
Okay, so the first they appear to have already learned, which is that, you need to have a national movement. It can't just be centered in Tehran. So, and that's practical because it's harder for the dictator. One of the reasons why the democracy movement in Beijing sadly kind of petered out in Tiananmen Square was because the entire sort of demonstrations and protests were focused on one very small piece of real estate. So it was easy for the Chinese to bring their military to bear and ultimately crush it. This time, it's much harder. It's like to put out these fires all over the country, and it means that you're not able to concentrate, the forces that you would use to sort of beat people and arrest them and et cetera. So that's one lesson I think that they've learned. The one that I hope they learn, and I've written a little bit about this, is that. We've seen some arson. We've seen certainly there have been some people on the outside who've called for, you should kill members of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And while I certainly would say that given the brutality of those of the organizations like the Basij or the Ministry of Intelligence and things like that, that, in some ways you could argue it's justified. It's very poor tactics. If it's a violent struggle, if it's a violent revolution, then the regime will win, because they have more guns. And the most important strategic thing is not amassing a million people in one place, although that's very impressive and it's important to get the rest of the world to see that you're doing that. But it's much more important to get like a local Revolutionary Guard Corps commander or a Basij militia person to basically disobey orders to disperse the crowds. That is very important. You want to create as wide a coalition as possible.
So
you're going to have to live with most of these people. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like you got to move the next day. And then finally, I mean, I'm a big believer in nonviolent kind of direct action in this respect, sometimes known as people power. The other big thing why that's important is that when you have a kind of vanguard, an armed vanguard, almost always turn into after, independence.
Yeah. So this is,
This is
Cromwell. This is Bolivar. This is the Sandinistas.
Mugabe.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's a question for you. In a Middle Eastern context and in an Islamic context, have we seen people power work in the way, and using that term loosely, I mean more as a kind of, I wouldn't say pacifistic, but a civil disobedience based movement, which you saw in, you mentioned, Tiananmen Square obviously didn't work in China, but that footage was widely circulated throughout Eastern Europe and was, everybody agrees that the sign of the demonstration or the footage of the demonstrations in the spring of 89 helped lead to the collapse of the tearing down of the Berlin Wall. In the fall of 89 and ultimately revolts in the Baltic states, has there been, which were marvelously and incredibly and unpredictably bloodless, with the exception really of Romania, the entire, communist world collapsed without, in Europe anyway. Has there been a case of that either in an Islamic country or in an Arab country where peaceful revolt has actually been successful?
Well, Tunisia is one example where I think we could say there's some success. And although I wouldn't call it success because Ayatollah Khomeini turned violent and purged his allies, but you can say that they threw off the Shah through largely a people power movement, although there were certainly violent elements of it. I mean, they took the Americans hostage and things like that. But and also, you know, we should, very important, you know, Persians, who are the majority ethnicity of Iran, are different than Arabs. And
right.
They're going to be.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely. Yeah.
And and the Iranian people, I think, are, you know, just there's more of a tradition of this kind of thing in Iran than there is in Saudi Arabia. Not to say that, you know, someday there couldn't be something like that in Saudi Arabia, but it's just there's not the same sort of history.
Well, you know, in terms of history, what is the role that the United States historically has played in Iran? And, you know, and how did that feed into at least the rhetoric, if not the reality, of the Islamic Revolution in 1979?
Well, listen, I mean, in 79, there was certainly an argument to be made. And these are factual. This is fact. Like the U.S., Kermit Roosevelt, the nephew of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, along with, his British counterpart, who I'm forgetting, you know, organized a coup against a populist Iranian president, Mossadegh. And in that coup, and this is very important, you know, there had already been a bit of a showdown, so that, you know, he dissolved the Iranian Majlis, their parliament, and there was a vying for power, and it was in the beginning of the Cold War. I'm not making excuses for it, but
that
ended up, securing the Pahlavi dynasty. Which,
right, and this, I mean, it is in the context again, and I think, you know, I'm probably more sharply critical of it than you, but we understand that there was a land grab essentially after World War II that was related to the Cold War, where the Soviets and their allies, which at that point included communist China, were looking for countries that they could kind of move into and influence. And the free world, NATO and the United States were doing exactly the same thing. And Iran is like, not only was it a huge country, but it was a relatively wealthy and relatively forward country.
Yeah, so, and extremely important in terms of oil, which was the name of the game at the time.
Was Mossadegh, was he religious in a way that even that the Ayatollah Khomeini would recognize? Because it seems in a weird way that the Islamic world is getting more and more hyper-religious, or at least, you know, the ruling classes are.
And this is the great irony of that you never hear. I mean, so first of all, I don't want to say that I'm defending.
I don't think you were at all. Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, the clerisy of Qom was, you know, basically, you know, brought into this coup plan and supported the assertion of Pahlavi as the Shah. So it shows that, you know, that clerical class, you know, it was a very different kind of thing. Khomeini represented a different strain of Shia Islam, and we can go on. But the point is that, you know, there's always been the clerics in Iran since the advent of Islam, and they play a part of that society. And, you know, Mossadegh himself was not particularly religious. He was, however, you know, saying he wanted to nationalize the oil companies. And that was in some ways a red line for the UK and the US at the time. Now that's the history.
The US was heavily involved by 1979 when you're looking at a very different, I mean, it's almost difficult to recapture that, even though those of us who lived through it remember it very well, where the Soviet Union was starting to move into Afghanistan in 1979. The Cold War looked like it was going to last forever. The United States itself seemed to be in a very weakened position globally as well as domestically. And it made sense. There was also a lot of huge actions within the Islamic world. And in Saudi Arabia, I mean,
right.
There
was the seizure of the holiest mosque, right?
Yeah, yeah. Where the and what the Sauds ended up calling in French commandos to clean it up. I mean, so I mean, there was, you know, it would be easy. And I guess most people, if they remember anything about it, it's from the movie Argo. But it's, you know, it was relatively easy for the Ayatollah Khomeini to demonize the Shah's regime, not simply as awful in itself, which it certainly was repressive and it was a police state, et cetera, but also as a puppet of Western regimes.
Right. But the Shah was also, I mean, the Shah made what I think is the mistake that Sisi is making right now in Egypt, which is that, you know, he failed to distinguish between what should be, you know, an opposition that would lead to kind of a democratization versus an existential threat to, you know, the order of things. And as that, and because of that, the original Islamic Revolution in 79 had, you know, Marxist allies in Iran, liberals, people who just wanted, you know, the same thing I think many Iranians want today, which is to be a normal country and live under, you know, a much less corrupt and more open society. Now, all of that said, as soon as Khomeini comes in, you know, his forces start by purging the Marxists, who become what's known today as the MEK or the Mujahideen-e Khalq. And, you know, they have a sordid history. They side with Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war. Their leader, Mariam Rajavi, now is based in Paris, much like the way that Khomeini was based in Paris before the 79 resolution. And, you know, they are, you know, not, I don't think they have as much credibility as they claim in terms of the Iranian opposition today. In fact, that's everybody I talk to who's not part of the MEK says that to me. But, you know, but that's the roots of this opposition start with the purges after the revolution. So that's, I think it gets back to another reason why it's important, if we can, to sort of lay out basic kind of, you know, a bargain, if you will, from Europe and America, which is to say, we're with you, opposition, but as long as you, you know, remain a nonviolent movement, and we will not continue to engage the Iranian regime if they suppress with violence what is largely a nonviolent movement. That is an important thing that the Europeans have yet to say, and it's, and that's extremely disheartening. I just wrote
a column about that. Have the Americans said that yet?
You know, Trump has not said it in his tweets, but that I believe is sort of the message that you're getting, you know, from other elements of the administration. But that's an important message to put. The other thing I think the United States can do right away is to place communication satellites over Iran and to work with trying to get around the regime's ban on the internet. That's something that the U.S. has some experience with, and that would be a quick way to undermine the regime without, you know, first of all, the CIA and you know, coups and paramilitary stuff. That's absolutely should not happen. That's going to make matters worse. It's not our revolution. It's their revolution. But as I said, we should think of it as ways to show solidarity. And I think the biggest thing is in civil society, which is, you know, we shouldn't forget the political prisoners the way we did after 2009. And it should be an ongoing kind of campaign, the way that, you know, we see in the academic left against Israel, that, you know, if a major European energy concern like Total wants to do a big deal with the Iranians for the PARS oil and gas fields or something, they should pay a kind of social price for that if there are still lots of political prisoners.
And of course, those tactics were also used in South Africa against South Africa.
And against the Soviet Union, who didn't allow Jews to immigrate. I mean, that's a very successful thing that happens in the West that's largely independent of a government and just is about activating civil society to show solidarity with people. And you know, that to me, you could be doing a lot more. I wrote a column last week recommending that, you know, nominating, if you will, Barack Obama would be a good candidate, somebody who understands community organizing, although I have since been told by a lot of Iranians that he's damaged goods and, you know, should stay out of it. But anyway. Uh-huh.
So here, let me go back to something that you touched on briefly in talking about why, you know, why the U.S. and the U.K. in particular were very, very interested in Iran after World War II, as were the Soviets. It had to do with oil. You know, oil is starting to creep up again towards $70 a barrel in the world market. But it's, you know, energy costs have been historically low for a very long time. And, you know, we're seeing some destabilization in countries that are oil rich, including places like Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Iran. Is Is it going too far to suggest that perhaps because oil is worth less than it used to be on the world stage, that this time it might be different because, you know, what the regime can rely on, or any regime that relies on oil wealth, it's tougher to make a buck doing that. And actually, you know, once you if you're losing the economy, ultimately, you also kind of lose the whip as well.
I don't know if I would go that far. We're not seeing massive instability in Norway or Russia.
Yeah, that's true. But we are seeing increasing poverty in Russia, and Norway is a very small country with more people. But I mean, for instance, the United States is effectively energy independent, and that also means that we're going to be less interested in parts of the world that are oil rich that we used to be interested in.
Right. I mean, I think we have, well, I think we're going to remain interested, but for different reasons. And the reason that we are going to continue to be interested in the Middle East is because of this broader trend of what we talked about before, which is kind of Islamic fundamentalism and how that is a destabilizing forces on the edges of the Islamic world. And that is something that we do have an interest in, because at least the last time I checked, America wants to be sort of, you know, not the world policeman, I like to say.
Oh, you want to say the indispensable nation, right?
Well, but I mean, that we have an interest in just, you know, stability, which is a fuzzy concept at times. But the idea that you don't want to see, and that's a quick way to break out into war is when you have religious fanatics, you know, claiming kind of a lost empire, which is what a lot of the activities on the extreme end of jihadism are doing and have been doing now since the 70s. So,
although that's awesome. Well, you know, we won't relitigate the Iraq war, but, you know, it doesn't quite fit that pattern. But here then, you know, what besides the kind of shows of support or rather, you know, what the U.S. would do and what we can learn from recent engagements in the 21st century that have not turned out particularly well for either the U.S. or the people that we are, you know, trying to help. We should be doing things like, you know, kind of civil society organizing, some technological interventions like communication satellites and things like that. What else? I mean, are there any world bodies, whether it's a NATO, which did not, you know, show its best face in Libya for sure, but like NATO or the UN the Arab League, things like this. Is there any hope there for useful interventions?
Well, I don't think that military intervention is called for at all in Iran.
Yeah. And by that, I mean, when I say intervention, I don't mean military intervention. I just mean, you know, like engagement somehow.
I mean, the most important thing that we need to do is we need to recognize that the diplomacy around the Iran nuclear deal was basically kind of conceding the shakedown of the Iranian regime, which was that you are going to lift sanctions and you're going to, you know, free up capital for us, and we are going to put on pause what was already in an illegal nuclear program. And instead, the diplomacy should generally follow the rule of linkage, which is that this is me speaking, and I don't know if catch on, but I think the most important thing is the big ask from the Iranians is that you can't brutalize your own population. You cannot keep lawyers and students and activists in your prisons, and you can't just exile and kill your most talented citizens. And if you continue to do that, then you will continue to find yourself isolated. And with that in mind, I don't think that the approach to sanctions should be we want to nuke your entire economy, so to speak, but instead it should be very much focused on making it impossible to spend money that is ill-gotten from the regime. So if you are, you know, kind of one of these newly minted billionaires from the Revolutionary Guard Corps, then, you know, you can't go on shopping sprees in London or Paris or New York. You can't send your kids to American or European universities. But also, you know, to find and try to seize that, I'm talking about the money that is sort of used to enrich that elite class. I mean, there is a multi-billion-dollar kind of slush fund controlled by the supreme leader, which is largely comprised of assets that are stolen, that are basically seized from many Iranian people, like homes and things like that. Well, that's a perfect target for the Treasury Department, and it does two things. One, it makes it, it's a real penalty to the people who are benefiting most from this unjust regime, but it's a message to the Iranian people that we're not trying to impoverish you. We're trying to impoverish the people responsible for your impoverishment, and that would really require a sea change in how we do our policy, and I hope we can do that. And I've been very critical of Trump, as you have. But the one maybe good thing about Trump is that he doesn't have, you know, much caught up in, like, you know, sort of the old ways of thinking about a lot of these things. And so he might be open to something like that in a way that Obama or George W. Bush or others maybe wouldn't be. Although I don't want to say George W. Bush, because I think George W. Bush understood the imperative to support, freedom movements when they arose. But let's leave him aside. But my point is that that is what I just described to you is something that, you know, the policy community on Iran from the right and the left don't talk about. But that is, I think, the third way that we should try to pursue.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Are we going to talk about the plastic Ono band?
We're going to leave that for, and we're also going to, for a second there, when you were talking about the Ayatollah Khomeini, I thought you were going to bust into a version of We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, which I believe also name checked.
The Bard of Long Island.
Right? Of Hapag Long Island or whatever. Well, we will leave it there. We've been talking with Eli Lake. He's a columnist at Bloomberg View. Check him out every week, multiple times a week at Bloomberg View. Eli, thanks for talking to the Reason Podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I am Nick Gillespie, your host. Thanks for listening. And please rate and review us at iTunes. Subscribe to us there as well. Thanks so much.